there's this question about whether the community can stay as a community or whether it just becomes effectively a resort playground.
The Anchorage Assembly considers approving a controversial housing development in Girdwood. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 5th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Sitka residents looking for halibut find something very different instead.
I think we both immediately saw the cone shape and the kind of trail coming out of it, thinking that it could be an underwater volcano of sort.
That volcano, those stories, and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if accessing your personal and family immunization records was as easy as checking your phone? The Docket app is a secure option that allows Alaskans to quickly access their immunization records. Need immunization records for school or travel? Docket makes it simple and is available for download from the App Store or Google Play Store. Learn more at vaccinationrecords.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The state of Alaska intends to sue Interior Secretary Deb Haaland to gain title to 10 trail corridors within the Yukon-Charley Rivers National Preserve. Attorney General Treg Taylor issued a notice of intent to sue late last month over 10 ribbons of land that total about 500 linear miles. It's part of Governor Mike Dunleavy's Unlocking Alaska initiative to assert state land rights. The claim is based on an 1866 federal law known as RS-2477. The law was intended to grant rights of way for roads across unused federal lands. It was repealed in 1976, but there's an exception for trails that were already established. Federal regulations allow the Interior Secretary to cede RS-2477 rights of way, essentially saying the federal government has no property interest in a trail. The trails the state intends to sue over all go across federal land. Some are near the community of Eagle. And Governor Mike Dunleavy has been sworn in for a second term in a ceremony with Lieutenant Governor Nancy Dahlstrom today in Anchorage. Dunleavy, a Republican last month, became the first Alaska governor since Democrat Tony Knowles in 1998 to win back-to-back terms. Dunleavy won the gubernatorial election with more than 50% of first-choice votes, so the race did not come down to ranked choice tabulation. His challengers were Democrat Les Guerra, independent former Governor Bill Walker, and Republican Charlie Pierce. During his speech today, Dunleavy did not delve into specifics about the agenda for his new term, but sounded a positive tone. The Anchorage School District faces a $68 million budget deficit next year, mainly due to declining enrollment and a lack of inflation-proofed funding from the state. District administrators have spent the last several months outlining potential budget cuts to the school board. Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas has been following their discussions and joins us now. Katie, how did we get here?
So part of the reason is a drop in enrollment. The district has 5,000 fewer students than it did 10 years ago. Another reason is that funding from the state hasn't been adjusted for inflation. So from the state of Alaska, the Anchorage School District gets $5,930 per student, and the district estimates that that number should really be about $900 more than that if you adjust it for inflation. And the last couple of years during the pandemic, the district has gotten a lot of federal relief money, and they used that money to close their budget gaps last year and the year before. And now that there's no COVID money coming in, the district has to deal with this deficit that's been sort of looming for years.
Right. It's just starting to catch up. And you've been following the discussions. What are the things that they say they're going to do to deal with this budget gap?
So administrators have been kind of presenting proposed cuts to the school board for their consideration since August. And the cuts really range in size and level of community support. So the one that's been kind of discussed the most, of course, is closing 6 elementary schools, and that would save up to $4 million, but of course has received a lot of pushback from those school communities. Savings within that vary depending on the school and repurposing plan. So if you let a charter school take over the building, you save about $840,000 per school at least. But if you turn it into a pre-K center, which they've proposed for 2 of the schools, you're only saving about $250,000. The most popular cut, of course, is to administration. So far, the district has found $2.9 million they could cut from their administrative budget, and they're still looking for more. Some other cuts include getting rid of a district-wide gifted program that would save about $3 million, moving sixth grade to middle school, which would save about $5.5 million, and then there's some other savings that would come from outsourcing hockey, swimming, and gymnastics to kind of private entities.
Gotcha. So as we're totaling up these cuts to try to fill this budget gap, what does that bring us to?
So all of that we just talked about would save $16 million. And again, that's including just school closures, middle school changes, the gifted program, outsourcing sports, and cuts to administration. And that leaves $51 million the district still needs to find.
All right. Well, that sounds like a lot of money to me. What other options do they have?
It's certainly a lot of money, but they have a couple other options. One of the more recent options that they shared in meetings is increasing the pupil-teacher ratio. That's a number that they use to figure out how many teachers to hire. It's not an average class size or a class size cap, but it's kind of a hiring guide. That ratio is currently 21 to 1 in kindergarten, and it goes up from there as the grades go up, so it goes up to a little over 30 to 1 for middle school and high school. Actual class sizes are often bigger, so the idea of increasing class sizes is something that would certainly get pushback from teachers. That said, you know, increasing that pupil-teacher ratio could save between $7 million and $32 million, and that's because the district would need to fill way fewer teaching positions than it's trying to fill right now. That's good news on the hiring side, and a lot of those positions are already vacant right now, but it does mean that class sizes would get bigger.
So let's say they increase that ratio as much as they can and they save $32 million more. That still leaves almost $20 million. What else can they do?
So as we talked about before, school board members and administrators are really pushing for an increase in state funding. But another source that the district has used in the past is its fund balance. And that's basically its savings, or the amount of money that it's not spending this year that they can roll over into next year. It's not clear how much that fund balance will be this year, but we know they've used that money to help with the budget in the past.
Okay, so there's quite a few different ideas floating around out there, and some of them seem like they would be fairly unpopular. What are parents and teachers saying about all of this?
The district has done a couple of surveys to get input from parents and teachers and other community members. One interesting thing from that first survey is that there's actually pretty broad support for closing and repurposing the schools. And of course, parents at those individual schools are very opposed to closing their own school, but across the district, most people actually supported it, according to the survey. Like I mentioned before, both parents and teachers are widely opposed to increasing class sizes. And also in that survey, the district asked people to send in their own ideas for what the district could do, and they shared those in a list. Some of those ideas were applying for grants, charging parents for before and after school, childcare, cutting the amount of technology used in the classroom, and other people wanted a temporary freeze on raises for all employees and cuts to some administrative positions, especially if they don't work directly with kids.
For parents or teachers or anyone else that's following this, what happens next?
Well, the next few school board meetings are going to include some major budget decisions, and I know a lot of students and parents are planning to attend and speak at those. The big one to watch is the December 19th meeting, where the board will vote on a proposed budget, which could include all the cuts that we just talked about.
All right. That was Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas. You can find more of her reporting at alaskapublic.org. Katie, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Casey.
It's been nearly a year since an investigation found that some Ketchikan student fans shouted racist comments and sounds during an annual rivalry game against Metlakatla's basketball team. That came on a country theme night organized by Ketchikan High School's Pep Club that was widely seen by Indigenous people as an offensive play on the tragic history of Native people's subjugation at the hands of Western settlers. The investigation by Ketchikan School District found that school officials and Pep Club leaders did not intend the theme to be racially provocative or insensitive, but the district said at the time that, quote, the negative impact of the theme to our communities was predictable and should have been prevented. Ketchikan School District has since apologized and pledged to take steps to prevent similar incidents in the future. Now, Ketchikan School Board has reached out to school district officials in Metlakatla to talk about the incident face-to-face. Gatgeta Hike is the president of Metlakatla School Board. She told the board during a meeting last week that she was approached by a member of Ketchikan's board at a recent meeting in Anchorage.
The Ketchikan board wants to meet with our board and to help repair the rift that was created from last year's incident.
Hike says the meeting would be a welcome step to address historical trauma. Metlakatla's board invited members of Ketchikan School Board to its next regular meeting on January 10th. Coming up, you might want to hang on to your bear spray because a few bears are still out and about this winter.
I would carry something. You know, if you're not going to carry a bear spray, maybe even a firearm to protect yourself.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance? United Way Healthcare Navigators are here to help you understand your new Affordable Care Act coverage options and opportunity for savings. You can call 211 or text GETCOVEREDAK to 898-211 to connect to a healthcare navigator. Enrollment is open now through January 15th. Call 211 today. This message sponsored by United Way of Anchorage.
At its meeting tomorrow, the Anchorage Assembly will consider approving a deal that will open up valuable public land in Girdwood for a housing development called Holton Hills. But in the resort community within the boundaries of Anchorage, the proposal is fraught. On one hand, Girdwood is desperately in need of housing for its workforce, but without interventions, only the wealthy will be able to afford any of the new homes. Girdwood realtor Sam Daniel, who leads an advisory committee on Holton Hills, looked up sales data in the community over the last 12 months. During a work session on Friday, he told the Anchorage Assembly that half of all condos sold for $526,000 or more, and the median price of a single-family home was $708,000.
We really do have a crisis in Girdwood. I did property management in Girdwood for over 20 years of long-term rentals. I used to manage 70 doors in Girdwood. I saw that start to drop about 10, 12 years ago. And what folks were doing was taking their old rental properties and turning them into VRBOs.
The pending deal calls for Anchorage's Heritage Land Bank to give developer CY Investments three tracts along Crow Creek Road that an appraiser valued at $2.1 million. Mike Edgington, who co-chairs the Girdwood Board of Supervisors, said the deal has positive elements. The mixed densities, the built-in requirements that a multifamily lot be given to a community housing entity, and restrictions on short-term rentals. But they're not satisfied with the overall deal. Edgington says even with the short-term rental restriction, he's concerned wealthy people will buy them as second homes and leave them unoccupied most of the year. He says Girdwood is at an existential inflection point.
There's this question about whether the community can stay as a community or whether it just becomes effectively a resort playground.
Connie Yoshimura is the CY of land developer CY Investments. Yoshimura told the assembly there's no way for the free market to make the new homes affordable in Girdwood.
You are not going to be able to build, based upon these costs for a home site, affordable workforce, low-income housing in Girdwood without having some mechanism for a subsidy.
She says it's time to establish some kind of housing authority to address affordability and workforce housing needs in Girdwood. Alaska tribal leaders are headed home from the White House Tribal Nations Summit in Washington, D.C. last week. The future of the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, was one of the big issues. And KNBA's Jill Freitas reports tribal leaders say they were reassured by what Vice President Kamala Harris had to say.
Vice President Kamala Harris vowed to protect ICWA and told the gathering she has a long history of fighting for its principles.
And back to my time doing that work as an attorney representing children and families in San Francisco, and working on ICWA cases to my time as Attorney General of California and partnering with tribal leaders and child welfare agencies and law enforcement officials to enforce ICWA. I will tell you, as I stand here as Vice President, that President Biden and I remain determined to work with you, with Native leaders, to safeguard the protections of ICWA.
Monique Baker, who works for the tribal government of St. Paul Island, says it was good to hear the White House acknowledge the challenges tribal families face.
It gives me comfort to know we have someone like Vice President Harris in this position who not only acknowledges what tribal families went through, Native children being torn away from their families and the trauma they endured, and knowing that something is being done to make sure this will never happen again.
The Vice President's support for ICWA comes after recent challenges to the law in the U.S. Supreme Court. Advocates say the decades-old law was created to keep Native children with Native families. Opponents argue that there aren't enough Native foster parents, and the law sometimes doesn't work in the best interest of the child. The court heard arguments last month, but has yet to rule on the case. The two-day White House Tribal Nation Summit concluded Thursday with topics ranging from veterans issues to a special message from astronaut Nicole Mann, who is currently in space on a mission, the first Native American woman to go to space. In Anchorage, I'm Jill Freitas.
The hourly wage rate in Alaska has historically stayed higher than those of other states, drawing in workers from outside to work in the state's lucrative industries like oil and fishing. And while Alaska's rate is still comparatively high, other states are catching up. Today, Alaska's average wage of $30.52 an hour is less than 10% higher than the national average of $28. Alaska ranks 8th overall nationwide. State economist Neil Fried says there are a few reasons why Alaska's had such a high hourly wage rate for so long.
For a period of time, part of it was you know, just to attract workers to this strange place that was, in the old days, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, pretty remote, difficult to get to.
Oil, construction, and fishing industries needed workers and paid them well, which contributed to the high average. But Fried says those jobs don't dominate Alaska's economy as much as they used to.
We have a more normal sort of mix of jobs. We have a very large service sector now that did not exist in those earlier decades. And generally, wages in that service sector tend to be lower.
Fried says other states' economies have outperformed Alaska's in recent years, making workers less likely to move here. State and local officials have expressed concern over outmigration, particularly among young people.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
Juneau Animal Rescue is resuming spay and neuter services for cats and dogs. The services are taking place at the rescue's facility for the first time since 2014. Samantha Blankenship is the executive director of Juneau Animal Rescue. She said some services will be offered at a lower price depending on income.
But we also are offering spaying and neutering for full price to people as well, because we know the veterinary shortage in town is real. The money from that goes back in to help the animals here at the shelter.
Juneau Animal Rescue had been offering low-cost services at Southeast Alaska Animal Medical Center until they closed in April. This summer, Juneau Animal Rescue had the highest number of cats in two decades. The spay and neuter services are limited to healthy animals that are not considered senior in age. The clinic won't be doing blood work on animals to determine their health before spaying or neutering them.
Right now, we're getting people in pretty quickly. There's not a long wait right now.
Blankenship said pet owners should bring paperwork with them that shows they qualify as low income, along with any vaccine paperwork. A couple of Sitka residents who were fishing for halibut last month noticed an unusual feature on their depth sounder as they set gear a few miles north of town. 200 feet below the surface of the water, the sounder slowly painted a picture of what appeared to be a volcano, a perfectly formed cone about 100 feet tall with a plume of gas trailing from the top. Experts who've seen the image say it's no cause for alarm. It's most likely a mud volcano, and it's not the only one near Sitka. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Locals don't use rods and reels much to fish for halibut in Sitka. Rather, most set a subsistence skate, a long line baited with a dozen or more hooks that is laid right along the bottom from a slowly moving boat. Jason Schmidt was doing just this in November near the entrance to Nakwasina Sound, 5 miles north of Sitka. Schmidt was on deck, paying out the line.
And then my friend who I was out fishing with was inside watching the depths on the sonar, and he noticed just a weird shape and called me in to look at it with him.
And what was it?
Well, I didn't know what it was when I first saw it, but it certainly looked like some things I had seen before. I think we both immediately saw the cone shape and the kind of trail coming out of it, thinking that it could be an underwater volcano of sort.
Had it been anyone else, this might have been an invitation to head for the hills. But Schmidt is the regional geoscience coordinator for the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. She'd been in Sitka for what has been a very interesting year geologically for the region. Her first impulse was to try and find the feature again and then get on the phone.
I'm aware of kind of the geologic context of Sitka and the surrounding islands, like, and spatially where the Queen Charlotte Fault is and where the Mount Edgecombe volcanic field is. And this location, we're all kind of just like not adding up with the story that I know about our geology here. And so, yeah, I just called the people who I knew had spent a lot of time thinking about the seafloor here.
It's a classic example of what we have seen out on the fault down around Dixon entrance.
Dr. Gary Green is a marine geologist, emeritus professor at the Moss Landing Marine Lab, and a leading expert on the undersea geology of the Queen Charlotte Fault.
These types of plumes that come out of this volcanic-like cone are associated with what we call mud volcanoes. And they're not really active volcanoes where magma comes flowing out, but it's mainly fluids that come up from depth and carry with it sulfide-rich gases and what have you.
The term mud volcano tends to conjure up thoughts of destruction, but with a few exceptions, their only similarity to terrestrial volcanoes, like the nearby Mount Edgecombe, is their shape. Dr. Cheryl Cameron is a state geologist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, and another expert, Jason Schmidt, consulted. She hesitates to draw any conclusions from the image Schmidt captured, but admits that there are plenty of possibilities.
It could be any kind of gas leaking out of the ground that would generate a plume. So it could be CO2, it could be methane, it could be fluid with particulates in it. There are a lot of possible causes that are not related to volcanism.
Nakwasina, where Schmidt was fishing, is not within the Mount Edgecombe volcanic field, but it's right next door. Edgecombe generated headlines last spring when an earthquake swarm signaled that magma was stirring beneath the long dormant crater. Subsequent radar studies showed that the flanks of the mountain had inflated by several inches over the last couple of years. Although the mud volcano is probably not volcanic, Gary Green says there's not enough information to rule out that it might be related to what's happening beneath Mount Edgecombe.
Could very well be associated with that magma that's moving up into the cone. It could be that the heat from that magma has started a convection of warm waters, hot waters that are now venting at that locality.
Jason Schmidt didn't catch any halibut, but that unhappy fact hasn't kept her away.
Well, we keep going back again. My friend whose boat I was on has gone back to the same place to check again and again, and it's still a bump under the water. I still have so many questions and would like to go back with better instrumentation where you could really see, but I'll leave that to Gary and Cheryl to direct.
Cheryl Cameron welcomes any and all observations of geologic phenomenon at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. Gary Green is going a step further and is looking for research funding to go down and take a look at the mud volcano, or at least take its temperature. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey. We'll be right back.
There was an unusual winter bear sighting in the White Mountains National Recreation Area north of Fairbanks. A group of skiers encountered a grizzly bear while traveling along a trail between two public use cabins. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the bear was not aggressive, but the incident raises the question of whether winter backcountry travelers should carry bear protection.
Barrett Flynn and two friends were on an annual Thanksgiving multi-day backcountry ski trip in the White Mountains National Recreation Area when they saw the bear. Flynn says they were skiing between Crowberry and Lee's public use cabins when his dog suddenly ran to his side.
Came and stood right next to me, which is fairly abnormal for him. Usually it means there's an animal.
Looking through frosty glasses, Flynn says he spotted a furry brown figure he initially assumed was a moose or a large wolf. He says his friends skied up from behind and together they confirmed the animal was a grizzly bear.
I see the hump and I was like, oh yeah, for sure that's a bear.
Flynn says the grizzly appeared young and thin and moved toward them unaggressively.
Curiously approaching, not running or doing anything, but I would say briskly walking towards us.
Flynn says the three stood together and the bear came within about 100 to 150 feet before veering off.
Turned around and scampered away.
Flynn estimates the whole incident lasted about 2 minutes. The encounter could have gone worse if Flynn had been alone or his dog wasn't so well behaved. He says the experience has made him think about winter bear protection.
If I'm going solo, like on a winter trip, yeah, I'm absolutely bringing a gun with me. If I'm going out with one other friend, probably a gun. If it's like 3 to 4, like maybe not.
Flynn reported the bear sighting to the Bureau of Land Management, which oversees the White Mountains Recreation Area. BLM Eastern Interior Assistant Field Manager Levi Llewellyn says the grizzly encounter is likely an anomaly.
You have the norm and then you have an outlier. So the bear might have been an outlier or maybe more bears are awake. We don't know.
Llewellyn advises non-motorized travelers to make noise, adding that bear spray is an option for winter bear protection as long as the canister is kept warm.
So, I'd put it inside my coat. I would carry something, if you're not going to carry a bear spray, maybe even a firearm to protect yourself, just something that you're proficient with and you're trained on.
Although very unusual, there have been some deadly winter bear encounters over the decades, including a starving grizzly that fatally mauled a woman and her baby outside a remote cabin in the Yukon Territory in November 2018. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Katie Anastas, Jeremy Shea, and Jill Freitas in Anchorage, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Annie Feit and Madeline Rose produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.